And I'm going to preface this with a couple of things. I am now 77, so
no, how can that I... picture isn't well. Don't worry about it. That picture isn't very. Picture's not very well
thought. There you go. There you go.
Thank you.
Okay. And understand, in stamp dealing, while I'm only 77, so I'm saying 70 years, but as a little kid, you deal with dealers, so it starts there and goes on. My wife, a little brief about my wife and I. Oh, yeah, sit down, okay. Sounds good. I got full down. We're now in our, A&D's now in its 53rd year, no store. We just do shows around the country, concentrating mostly on our home turf in California. Our stock, go ahead, next. Weighs in at about 5,000 pounds. We drag this stock around the country on our annual 30,000 miles of travel to shows. But of course, as this shows, there's always room for one more stamp. We have busy shows most of the time. I think that's the next. But then, occasionally, we have a quiet show. Sometimes a very quiet show. Now, granted, this was posed, but yes, the show was open. And yes, there were no customers. So this was Midafil in Kansas City.
We have never had a quieter show.
Seems everyone already had their fill.
Just no people. Next.
There were no people there.
We do our work next. We do our work in our home office, which is happy time for me. A mountain of stamps and cops on TV. See the guys taking away in handcuffs over there. And at the lower left is Sue's desk. Note that the seat is empty. She can't stand all the screaming and sirens and gunfire and so forth, so I wear the earphones. That keeps things nice and quiet. And next, yes, sometimes the entire revenue is both baffling and overwhelming, as you can see from this photo shot at Fresno 2000. And there I am over there saying, oh, God, this is going to cost a lot of money. And she's saying, how did I ever get involved with this yo-yo? But a little perplexed. Anyway, okay, so we go to the good, the bad, and the ugly. In my half century, I've been burglarized 3 times, held up at gunpoint 2x, shot 1x. And so there, that's so much for the bad side. The amazing and good news is that on very rare occasions, we take a bit of time off. Sue likes quiet reading and a good book. I go with my good friend, John Van Alstyne. He was a supplies dealer at shows for many years, to the Modesto Ridge Runners annual run in Hawthorne, Nevada. Next. Here's John and Jim. You'll remember him from the supplies man. Neat and clean with John's shiny dune buggy. And here we are. Ten hours, 3 6-packs, and 102 miles later, Jim the Pillsbury Doughboy, covered with alkali, and driver John, dead man walking, or in this case, sitting. Okay, so I'm going to preface my story of 70 years of stamp dealing, a patchwork of legendary stars, curmudgeons, and true crazies, by telling you that as age progresses, my memory isn't super sharp, so forgive me if I stumble on a few facts. Every morning I find a few more marbles rolled out on the pillow, and I know I'm going to run out one of these days, but I feel my hair's drawn gray from sucking gray matter from my brain. But in any case, while this is not about me, but
is
that's true. And while this is not about me, but about stamp dealing in the Bay Area, I need to briefly tell you how I got involved. I was born in 1931. I was a Depression baby, and my mother and dad kidded that that's when they looked at me, they were depressed. But in any case, the big turning point was 1938. Had my tonsils and adenoids out. My sister, Barbara, who felt really sorry for me, went down to Woolworths on Shattuck Avenue in Berkeley and bought a 15-cent stamp album and a 10-cent bag of Golden Galleon mix, which really got me interested, although I don't know about the Golden Galleon. It was about 80% that the 50-cent times red sewers from France that was filling up the bag. But anyway, that's all right. So this was certainly the golden age of stamp collecting.
You're still bitter, huh?
We traded.
Yeah.
We traded with kids in the neighborhood, and everybody had a stamp album, and I had the old red covered modern with the, you know, the tall building and the plane next. And then there was Captain Tim's Ivory Stamp Club. There was the Oakland Tribune Stamp Club and the San Francisco Examiner Stampeders Club. And who can forget those pages of ads in Popular Mechanics and Mechanics Illustrated, where 10 cents brought you all kinds of triangles. I mean, and I can remember cutting old man Dixon's lawn across the street for 3 hours, got my 75 cents, which I maybe ran down and spent at Globe Stamp Store in Berkeley. And some of you may remember Parker Hayden Sr. He was, you know, he was like 6'3 and 300 pounds. It kind of reminds you of William Howard Taft without a mustache. And I was always kind of a little frightened of him, but he took my 75 cents in any case. Later, I got a Berkeley Gazette paper route and was making 15 bucks a month and moved up to a two-volume Dansko. For years, my favorite philatelic time was sitting down and putting stamps in my album while listening to The Lone Ranger at 7:30 every night on KFRC. And I'll tell you something, that this is kind of strange and off the chart, but it was about 10 or 15 years ago that I thought back to that time and remembered all the times I listened to The Lone Ranger. And then I realized, and I can do this without looking at the script, the way that program started, and some of you will remember it, with his faithful Indian companion Tonto, the daring, resourceful mass rider of the plains, led the fight for law and order in the early American West. Nowhere in the pages of history could be found a greater champion of justice. Let us return to those thrilling days of yesteryear from out of the past and the thundering hoofbeats of the great horse Silver. And then the nine shots from the six gun and so forth. Anyway, the first thing you did was you learned Murphy's Law. One Christmas I was given a Scott catalog, and in checking against my stamps I realized that I was really a very rich kid. Some of the stamps I had cataloged at 10 bucks a piece. It was the beginning of a long learning process that all of us have gone through. That all is not as it seems. The stamp that catted $10 reappeared with a different perforation at 2 cents. It took a long time to realize that Murphy's Law lives, and you can have to live with disappointment. If there's an expensive variety, you have the cheap one. The toast lands jelly side down, or parenthetic, my two Murphy favorites, friends come and go, but enemies accumulate. And the other one is the Smith & Wesson beats Four Aces. Now, this was a time when you would go to, quote, the city. I don't know if people say that anymore, but when I was a kid, you'd go to the city, and the women wore gloves and hats and silk and all that kind of stuff. But I did not wear hats and gloves and silk stockings. On Saturday in mid-40s, my buddy Ray Kovac and I would take the Key Route train to San Francisco to hit all the stamp stores. There were legendary stars like Frank Back, the Phoenix Stamp Company. Next. And then there was Frank Sankey at the U.S. Stamp Company. These are pretty, I was kind of afraid to visit. Bach was on the second floor, and you all saw shadows behind the frosted windows, and you dreamed the day maybe when you could go in there and buy from him. But when we were old and rich, we maybe even would get invited to his legendary bank vault, which was downstairs in the basement of that building on Mark. But anyway, descriptions of that stock that Frank had in the safe deposit box was legendary. Sankey's U.S. Stamp Company on Bush Street, whose huge stock was legendary, was a little more inviting, but it was usually full of adults with paper money. But there was always the Emporium, Mowers, and we have Jewel Charles Waters. You can bump these up. And Dana Stamp Company. So forth, Solomon's and others, where they would accept coin, sometimes begrudgingly, but they accepted it nevertheless. Carfare was always in a separate pocket because you knew you were not going to get home if you didn't kept it in with the stamp money. Sometimes to save carfare and thus more money, we would tour the East Bay. Globe Stamps was always on the list on Center Street. In Oakland, there was Harry Gray's. And then there was Jack Hughes. They both operated stores across from each other on 17th, and I remember looking in at Jack Hughes's place, and had these big bushy eyebrows, and I was about 10 or 11, and he'd be working in a stock book and look up out the window on those big furrowed brows, and I'd just take off like a rocket. I was not going to go confront that man for anything under a $10 stamp, and I didn't have $10. So anyway, Ray and I discovered girls, and priorities changed rapidly. Money now went for movies and popcorn, and the stamp books gathered dust. Now, okay, the decision to become a dealer, time has passed now. I got married. My first wife, my bride Marilyn, got immediately pregnant, had to quit her job. I was making $42 a week as a cub reporter for the Sacramento Bee, so I decided to get into the stamp business, sell off my old album, buy wholesale approvals. D.D. Sweatzer in Florida was always a good bet for some good stamps. After 2 years of struggling, I figured I was making about 20 cents an hour, so I said, if somebody's got to be making money in this business, so I advertised to buy collections, which I would then sell to dealers. So I was kind of in the shadowy world of the best pocket dealer. In the 60s and into the 70s, I got to know many of the dealers well, and an amazing array of regular guys and a few curmudgeons and a few crazies. Some of the regular guys, Globe, Parkey and his mom, both shops in both Berkeley and Walnut Creek. It was a popular operation, both with walk-ins and approval. Globe closed in the late 80s, and Parkey passed away a few years ago. There was Lamps and Stamp Store, which was a landmark at 23rd and McDonald in Richmond for a half a century. Most people don't know that he was a poet, a radio script writer, and actually in 1946, a leader in the move to have the United Nations make the East Bay its permanent location. Of course, then Rockefeller came along with $8.5 million and then went to New York. Ed McConnell, quite a mellow fellow in Berkeley, near the UC campus and a couple of blocks from Parkey's place. Rosy cheeks, enjoyed a glass of sherry every afternoon, I think maybe sometimes more than one glass. Very knowledgeable guy. I guess the highlight of his life, he was held up at gunpoint one afternoon, either before or after the glass of sherry, I'm not sure. But anyway, the guy took the money. Ed reached under the desk there, whipped out a shotgun from under the counter and killed him on the spot. A lot of people don't know that. But he then retired and sold out to Malcolm Hodkins. And who can forget Hodkins, the man in the Tribune Tower, a major player for 30 years and just one heck of a buyer. He did extremely well. There was Jewel Charles Waters, later run by Ed Weinberg. Ed long ago retired, but still stays in the game by helping out Stanley Pillar. And, of course, Stanley's been around the stamp business for upward of 40 years. He was with Bechtel. Bechtel collected stamps, so there was a good start. Later went with Wolfer, Seagulls, bought out O. Jack Taylor's stamp shop in Oakland many years ago, and just 2 years ago moved the shop to Walnut Creek. Stan's on the board of directors of the ASDA now, and I had a new dealer come to me one time and said, Stanley came over and he seems to be a little abrasive, and I said, abrasive. I said, Stanley's an absolute pussycat. Now you should have seen him 40 years ago. You talk about abrasive. But his new wife Debbie's kind of calmed him down, and when Stan talks and he's got a point to make, the decibel level goes up, and then Debbie is next to him.
Boy, the
arms down, bring the decibel level down, and Stanley does. And anyway, a heck of a knowledgeable guy, you've got to admit. Speaking of O. Jack Taylor, he and Mike Campbell got together back in the 60s to operate a store in Oakland. Jack had U.S., Mike had foreign, so they just kind of split the shop in half. They found a location near Lake Merritt, a home right next to the Grand Lake Theater. When you opened the door, you looked right, this was an old home. When you opened the door, you looked right into a fireplace, thus Fireside Stamp Company. Sometimes they actually had a fire going. Mike later moved his operation to Sunnyvale, where he's been for many years. Then there was, and then there was Wolfer's, certainly the biggest stamp operation, I think, in the Bay Area in the 60s and onward. What with the ground level store in Kearney Street and the many auctions over the years. And you can't think of Wolfer's without thinking of John Feeders and Phil Vogt, two mainstays of the operation. John cut his philatelic teeth in his dad's shop in Phoenix. He and Phil left Wolfer's and joined forces around 1980. They later went out on their own. John bought out Mr. Z's in Burlingame, and a few years later he sold the shop to Phil and Pam Vogt. It was Barton Felder. For a number of years, they had a big operation buying stock from all over the world and selling through their price list. Aubrey later went out on his own and ran a number of successful auctions. And I always remember Felder, his determination to hang on to that, those 1988 Scott prices when he was describing stock. He held on to that for about 10 years and finally gave up the ghost. As you probably know, that was the crisis year when Scott decided to make realistic prices without telling anybody, and that created a lot of fussing. There was Niall Searles, one of my very best friends over the years. He came on the scene in the 60s. He and Stan State and San Leandro formed the Rusty Dusty Stamp Company, and they both later went out on their own. Niles was very successful, was always the gentleman, stood up when a woman walked into the room, and was so honest it was absolutely scary. I had the privilege of buying his stock when he retired in 89. He passed away earlier this year. And, of course, you can't forget Jean Marie's Stamp Shop in Concord, run for over 30 years by Jean Marie Palomares. There was always something to go through at her shop, and Friday nights was legendary. That was when good customers like Tim Burgess, David Eshelman, and others, including Sue Engelhart, who worked, my present wife, who worked for Jean, and for whom I married in 2001, they gathered to feast on pizza. The order was always extra large, double pepperoni, triple cheese. That was the and the list goes on and on. There was Avon Stamp Auction, run by Von Reimers, who operated out of his home on 46th Avenue in San Francisco. I still hear stories, and I'm not sure Wayne may know this or not, but I still hear stories that at Westpac, he used to leave such a huge pile of trash behind his table that the hotel threatened to not allow him in following years. Whether that's true, I don't know. Oh, and how about Leo and Dorothy Trueblood, who ran the Lamb and Lion Stamp Den? I don't know who was the lamb and who was the lion, but in any case, they did. They were on the show. I suspected the case. And of course, there's Chris Harmer and Kurt Schell, both on the stamp scene for many years, now operating the very successful Harmer Schell stamp auctions. And now we come to the wonderful curmudgeons. Then there were the curmudgeons, and I say this with all due respect. They were fascinating people who simply set out a path a bit different from the rest of us. There was Tom Singer, a U.S. stamp dealer who attended major shows in the Bay Area for decades. He had an exceptional stock, but I think sometimes wished he could still sell his stamps without having to deal with customers. Anyone who questioned or even hinted that the stamp he was selling might have a fault or was priced too high brought immediate action. Tom would gently but firmly pull the stamp book out of the customer's hands, close it, put it back on the table behind him. No words were spoken. The prospective customer, a bit perplexed at that action and the ensuing silence, finally would get up and leave. Tom liked to buy from other dealers, and including me on occasion, and always offered a fair price, but to see if you had anything worth his attention, he'd lean over the table and, without a word, would start pushing all the customers' lists and boxes and books out of the way, you know, and his customers saying, what the hell's going on here? And he just had to see the stamps that were under the glass, and the only way to do it was to scoot all these nasty customers out of the way. But in any case, he was...
But Diane was a sweetheart.
Yes, yes, Diane was a sweetheart. But then there is one of the great stories from Tom is what I call the great United Nations fiasco. And this was when CalPEX was going, and I think they had a couple of different locations, but this location, I think, was kind of kitty-corner across from the Jack Tar. I'm not sure what building that was, but I think it was
The Richelieu Hotel.
Richelieu, okay. So one of Tom's customers gave him a UN collection. This is back in the 70s or early 80s, I guess. And UN was very hot, and number 38 was going for $500 and all that. And the guy decided to concentrate on US, so he gave his UN collection to Tom to sell. Well, of course, Tom wasn't a UN kind of guy. And he kept it for a couple of months. Then the next show, this guy comes by, and Tom says, you know, I'm really sorry I wasn't able to sell the collection. So, or he said, I wasn't able to do anything with this, so, you know, take it back. So the guy picked it up and left. And that was fine. And the next day in the late afternoon, one of Tom's customers comes by and says, Tom, how'd you do with that UN collection? And you could just see the little light bulb go on, and Tom saying, oh, God, He just handed it. He thought this guy he saw was the guy that had given the collection. So he pushes these four volumes of UN to this guy who said, well, whatever, you know, and picks up. Picks it up and leaves.
Pretty frightening.
I remember one, another great one was an ASDA show where Tom was, there was a guy who was really kind of flaky, and all the dealers kind of knew you didn't take a check from and all that, and the head of the ASDA, how could I forget his
name?
Joe Savarese, yeah, was kind of, you know, making signals behind Tom, telling him, you know, don't take a check and all this kind of stuff. And the guy bought about $12,000 worth of stuff, and Tom took the check. And Joe afterwards, the guy said, you shouldn't have done that. That guy's checks are not. And Tom said, that's all right, I'm insured. And Savory says, you're insured for loss, but you're not insured for a bad check. Anyway, and the check bounced, and that was the end of the story. But anyway, so much, that's what. But Tom was a nice guy. He just, as I say, a different path. And now, of course, for a curmudgeon, you got to talk about Johnny Suwakowski. Made his mark as the California Stamp Company. He bought out the Tribune Stamp Club, bought collections heavily from everywhere, and delved deeply into new issue service with he and his wife. They carried that on for a year. John was involved with a lot of stamp clubs, putting on shows. He always knew where he stood. I still remember him coming close to biting my head off because I showed and sold a German collection to another dealer without checking with him first, and he was really a dick. And despite warnings from other dealers, he insisted on putting much of his stock out in open boxes in number two glassines. And I still remember a show at the Twin Pines Stamp Club annual show in San Pablo, and just heard this shriek, and Johnny was just jumping up and down. And someone had apparently, with these open boxes, had reached in and pulled out everything he had from B1 to B25 in France. Now, that's, if anybody knows France, that is a lot of money, and we probably had a prime off the ceiling, but that was just his way. And then, of course, we have Jory Stamps in Oakland. Jory Norball, some of you may or may not remember, but he was a mainstay in the show trade for many years. He was a gruff old Swede who took no guff but handed out a lot of it. His United Nations stocks was absolutely huge at a time when UN was king of the hill and 38s were going for $500 and more. One day at a show, an elderly lady showed up and asked him to take a look at this nice little one-volume collection. And Jory kind of breezed through it and shook his head with jowl swinging back and forth and handed it back and said, that's just junk. The woman burst into tears. You know, it was my late husband's, and he died last month, and he worked all his life on it, and, you know, on and on. And everybody was kind of, you know, hushed tones. And obviously touched, Jory thought for a moment, and then in sign of said in hushed tones, it's still junk. It's still junk. And finally, there were a few crazies. There's one Bay Area dealer, and I've got to say this, considering things could tend to be libelous, let me just substitute the word bizarre and avoid names. There's one Bay Area dealer who has a front door always locked, who responds to the bell from an upstairs window, demands a promise that you spend at least $50 before you will be let in. Not too long ago, he sent letters to all dealers in the East Bay Area accusing them of restraint of trade, whatever that means. He'd probably do better if he left the front door unlocked and forgot the $50 minimum. Then there was a dealer who had a stock which was not always as it seemed. He made a rather astounding statement after a customer for the third time returned a Washington Franklin coil that the foundation said was bad. His response, and I think he must have said this obviously without thinking, he blurted out, if you keep sending these to the PF, I'm not going to sell you any more coils. Well, okay, so there you are. Then there was a dealer I barely knew who called and suggested that, these things happen, not very often, but it does happen. and suggested that I should underbid on the collection we were both looking at so that the purchase price would be great, we could split the profits. And I responded in the negative, and at the same time saying, isn't this a question of ethics? And his response was classic. He says, I'm not the person to ask. So, okay. And the last, we have the promoters. And no, you can't talk about stamp duty without talking about promoters. A veteran promoter of some 50 years ago was Cliff Horst, who held shows at the old Jack Tar in San Francisco and other locations. And there's one great story about Cliff, who I think just recently passed away.
Oh, really?
There was a show that he held at the airport motel, which was just south of the airport. This was in November, and we were having like the storm of the century. I mean, it was just really raining. The show had been on about 40 minutes, and the lights went out. And this was a closed room, so everything just turned completely black. And so Cliff figures, we got to get light in. Now, at the back corner, there was a dealer who was notorious, a cover dealer, but was notorious for just having everything kind of all stacked up and, you know, laying around on the table. Well, Cliff crashes open the emergency doors in the back where they have the fire escape going down. Well, there's about a 40-knot wind coming dead level, and this guy's stock just disappears, right? I mean, he was getting covers from dealers for 2 days from the other side of the room. I mean, they were just all over the place. That was the last time Cliff ever threw open the door. Interesting enough, Horst PR Man was an ad salesman from the San Francisco Examiner by the name of Ed Rosen. Ed later went on his own at the height of the stamp and was doing about 30 shows a year across the country. He slowed down when the market collapsed in the 80s, but continued with some shows concentrating in California. And, of course, still operating the House of Zion Stamp Shop. And, of course, there was Marshall Birdie in San Jose, Ken Lerner in Fairfield, and most of them have faded. I know I missed dozens of dealers, part-time dealers, wannabe dealers who popped up in the philatelic scene like corks in the water and just only to drift out to sea and never be heard from again. Forgive me for those omissions. And that brings us to today. There are still a few stamp shops and more than enough shows to go around, but with the internet we have a new era and the times they are changing. Perhaps 50 years from now an old time dealer will stand before you and review some of the legendary website he remembers. Stamp collecting, I'm sure, will continue to thrive. Thank you. Hey.
Really?
I'll bet you.
Jack Tar?
Yeah. Okay.
She's going to take a picture and get some questions here. Okay.
Okay, here we go. But the light is.
Good. Okay. I saw a hand. Yeah.
Yes. You mentioned the name. What happened to Peter? John Peters, right?
John Peters went down to back home to Arizona, Phoenix. Yeah, where his dad, he worked for his dad. His dad had a stamp shop, I think, on Speedway Avenue in Phoenix, out near the college and the university. And he did a lot of work on the internet for a while. And then about 3 or 4 years ago, he bought a UPS store, a mail type thing, which is completely away from stamps. Now, I don't know whether he's still doing anything on the internet, but I have not heard from him philatelically in a couple of years. So I think he's branched out into a new whatever. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, among your crazies, you might mention that Avon Stamps was a Russian fellow. It was auctioneer with Russian. And they used to sit behind their table and talk in Russian, and they'd be insulting their customers.
George was the other one.
If you want to talk about Peter Guder, who was in the military and went to the school down in I think Fort Ord. He gets these Russians talking back and forth that don't know that he can speak Russian. He lets them yap on for about 20 minutes in the in Russian.
Okay. Well, that was two great talks, and I know everybody appreciated it. And before you disappear here, we've got not to give you the official
C3A,
the official certificate that I think Wayne alluded to earlier. We still have them. These are the original ones. I think we've got enough for maybe about another 40 or 50 years. But there you are. We've used
Thank
one
you
up.
Very much.
And in addition to that, another thing that Wayne alluded to, you get a copy of From the Wigan Meals.
Very good. Thank you.
Wayne, you get another certificate for the other half of your talk.
Thank you, sir.
And no book.
Oh, thank you.
Bill, I've got an extra copy. I'll bring Wayne.
No, I'm fine.
I'm afraid that Wayne may have given his talk before the book was published.
I've given